Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm all right. Let me ask you a question. What is your approach to getting dressed in these strange days?
I still believe in getting dressed. What about you?
Dressing gown most of the time.
Really?
Yeah, but I am, trying to belt it during working hours.
That is interesting.
I just want to say I'm only wearing the dressing gown when I'm working from home. But when I go to the BBC, it's sweatpants. How's your week been?
My week's been fine. It hasn't been mainly involving my dressing gown. Actually, I did my first broadcast interview from home about support for business. And I think I'm in quite an unusual category because I'm a victim of fake news, but it's redounded to my benefit.
Go on.
So basically, I got quite a lot of tweets after, or at least one tweet, which then led to more tweets and messages from random people who I know, saying that people were very impressed with my collection of Football Manager behind me on my bookshelf. And so a Football Manager is like a game, basically. You know, it's like a computer game.
Yeah.
And it's like, and the thing was, there's quite a big collection. And I thought to myself, my children must be playing Football Manager. I kind of didn't really compute. And then the next day, I suddenly thought, no, my children don't play Football Manager because they don't have the thing that you play Football Manager on. And then I realized that somebody had Photoshopped it on. And so I'm now getting all these tweets from people saying how impressed they are by my, Football Manager collection. Relatives of people I know who say, my cousin wanted you to know that they're really impressed with your, which team are you managing? You know, it's kind of highly consistent. And I kind of even feel bad about correcting it. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's great. So what I'm interested to know is, what had they Photoshopped that over? Was it your collection of ZX Spectrum games?
No, it's just on the bookshelf. And for some reason, I didn't clock that it wasn't mine until I realised it wasn't mine. Anyway,
that's brilliant.
It's a rare example, as I say, of fake news being of benefit. But I'm sad to disappoint people. I think I had a thing on Wikipedia saying I was in a punk band once. And I didn't rush to take it down. And then somebody else did, I think.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Did you go out and do the clap for the NHS on Thursday?
I did. I always feel incredibly emotional at it. And I sort of think, why would we ever stop doing it?
Yes, that's a really good point. Let me ask you a question. Is it okay to talk to your neighbours at a responsible distance during the clap?
I think in a sort of wavy way, yes.
Right, because I was asking my next-door neighbour about a parcel, and then my wife started glaring at me, and she said I shouldn't be asking about a parcel during the clapping.
But I don't think you should be doing your business during the clapping.
I didn't stop clapping.
No, I think it's a little bit Larry David. I don't think you should be doing your business during the... I think you do the clapping, then do the parcel, or do the parcel, then do the clapping, I think.
All I need is a rule to adhere to.
Okay. Focus on the clapping.
Okay.
Don't you think?
Good to know.
You know what's interesting for me is there's a sort of really interesting kind of domino effect in this, which is at the beginning, people went out and were like, and were sort of saying, I don't know whether anyone else would be doing it. And I was pleased to see other people doing it. And then more people did it. And then we all saw that some people were using pots and pans. So there are a lot more pots and pans this week.
Yes. Yeah. I told you somebody's got a trombone on our road.
I think you may have mentioned this. Yeah. Shall I get out my Glockenspiel? Or recorder?
Yeah. Should we talk about what we're talking about this week?
This week, Jeff, we're talking about the relationship between crises and social change. Lots of people are beginning to think about the long-term impact of coronavirus on our society and our economy. We're looking at what can be learnt from the past and asking what determines whether major crises lead to positive or negative change. I must say we are joined by two incredibly erudite, I would say, and sort of fantastic guests. Historian Walter Scheidel, his book, The Great Leveller, is all about what are the forces in society that led to lower inequality? What are the events? In particular around catastrophic events. He's examined inequality over thousands of years and came to some interesting conclusions about their impact. I should say to you, my mother bought this book for me for Christmas at my request, I think 2 or 3 years ago. So I'm really pleased to be talking to him. And then we're talking to distinguished sociologist Theda Scotchpole about the origin of the welfare state and her views about the history of social change.
Very, very festive in the Miliband household, isn't it?
Yes. I'm conforming to stereotype, I think. Yes. I'm owning it.
Good, good. Glad to hear it. And we have a cheerful person for you this week. And it is somebody. It's a conversation we recorded a while ago before the coronavirus crisis. And it was Ed was extremely giddy to talk to him. It's Paul Sinton-Hewitt, who is
great
the man behind Parkrun. Our Parkrun episode remains one of our most popular ones.
Yeah.
And we finally got to meet the man of whom it was his brainchild.
Yeah, he's a great man. And what's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is it was my son's 4th birthday this week. So we had planned a party prior to all this and we had to cancel it, so we had to improvise a little bit, but we had a lovely day. We did we made a home cinema, we closed all the curtains and watched Trolls World Tour. I got loads of his friends from nursery and teachers to send video messages and edited them all together.
Oh, and, well done.
He's obsessed with crocodiles at the minute, so I found somebody who couriered us a crocodile birthday cake. So yeah.
And what was his big present?
His big present was a DJ mixer.
My God.
You know, like a sort of Fisher-Pricey one. One of his friends has got one and he's sort of a little bit obsessed by it.
Maybe you should get me one of those.
Is that what you want for your birthday?
So is it because he sees you doing it?
No, I don't think so. We've tried to, my wife and I have both tried to conceal our careers from him as much as possible, right, lest that he would want to go into either of our professions. But he's seen it in some film or something. It's far more sophisticated than what I'd had when I was doing my mobile discos.
And he sort of was perfectly, he had a nice time. Yeah. It wasn't too affected by it.
Yeah.
Well, that's really good. And it is your birthday on the day this episode comes out, Monday.
That's right, yes.
You're 40 this year, aren't you?
I think, well, I'm officially entering my, is 40, does 47 count as your late 40s?
Or mid.
Okay, so I'm still in my mid 40s. No big change for me. As somebody who's in a, you know, an entirely different decade of their life, do you have any words of wisdom for me?
I just prefer low numbers. The second number being low is what I prefer psychologically.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. What's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, my reason to be cheerful is actually thanks to you, because you texted me to say that the World Snooker Final of 1985, the final frame between Dennis Taylor and Steve Davis, was available on iPlayer. Now, this was a seminal event for me. I my dad was not a great fan of sport, but the one sport he really got into was snooker. I stayed up till 12:30, along with I think 18 million other people, watching that World Snooker Final. And the thing I remember most about it was that I was doing my art O level, and you had to submit some coursework. And I had an absolutely, my mum was away, and I had an absolutely massive row with him because I basically hadn't, which is very unlike me, I basically hadn't bothered to do any of the coursework, and I had 2 days to do it. And I sort of said, he said, well, I said, I'm not going to bother because I don't care about art. And he was pretty furious. So I then, there was a tree outside our house. So I then did a picture of the tree. And this is a complete injustice. I got an A in my art O level. And it is a total injustice because I cannot draw for toffee.
But that tree is now in the National Gallery.
It's in my mum's house, actually.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Now, to talk about this issue of crises and what kind of change they lead to, and whether they lead to progressive or reactionary change, I'm delighted to say that we are joined by Walter Scheidel, who is Professor of History at Stanford University. He is the author of The Great Leveller, Violence and the History of Inequality from the Stone Age to the 21st Century, an incredibly interesting and sweeping historical book, as I said in the introduction, one that my mother was kind enough to buy me for Christmas. Walter, thank you so much for joining us. You're actually in Manhattan, are you?
I'm in Manhattan right now, which is where all the action is.
And how is lockdown for you?
It made the city very quiet. We are holed up at home very peacefully, and I get a lot of work done. But it's a pretty grim situation.
Yeah, it really is. And, of course, you are somebody who has written about pandemics in the context of your book, The Great Leveller. Just for our audience, just set out at a high level your argument about the relationship between catastrophes and inequality that is really the main argument you make in The Great Leveller.
Well, my argument in a nutshell is that every single time you see a major reduction in economic inequality at any time in recorded history, it was caused by a major disaster, some kind of catastrophic event. And those disasters came in four different flavors. That's why I call them the four horsemen of leveling. Two of them were common in most of history in pre-modern agrarian societies. One is the collapse of states, which happens all the time. Think of the fall of the Roman Empire. And that makes sense because early states are really vehicles of inequality. They favor the rich and powerful, even more than modern states do. And when governmental structures unravel, everybody is worse off as a result, but the rich have more to lose. And so inequality goes down. The second driver would be a very severe plague. I guess we'll come back to that perhaps in a moment. And then in the 20th century, two new leveling forces appear, very closely related: mass mobilization warfare, World War I, and especially World War II, and communist revolutions in Russia out of World War I, in China out of World War II, which of course have the objective of reducing inequality by often very violent means.
So, Walter, this theory, was this an inkling you had and then you looked for evidence in the data to back it up? Or was it something that the data suggested to you?
Well, my inspiration was really Thomas Piketty's book on capital in the 21st century, who looked at the last couple hundred years, which for an economist is actually quite impressive. But I'm a pre-modern historian, and I felt it would be a good idea to look at the full sweep of history to see if we could identify a broad pattern. And I'd always had an intuition that this might be the case. And it turned out to be true, at least that's my argument, that it turns out to be true that we can find this pattern, which hadn't been previously observed over hundreds and in some cases thousands of years. So I think in this case, a pre-modern historian was able to make a real contribution because everything fell into place quite quickly. And that's what made it possible for me to finish the book just in a couple of years, because I couldn't really find any genuine counterexamples to my thesis.
Just say something about, we're obviously in a pandemic at the moment. People are reaching for historical parallels, and no historical parallel is completely accurate. But you start off by talking about the plague, which I believe the 14th century plague, is that correct?
That's correct. That's the most dramatic case.
And the impact that had on economic inequality in Europe. And it's not going to apply in our case in the same way, but just explain your analysis of that, because it'll be interesting for our audience.
What happened in the Black Death in the 14th century is that bubonic plague comes in and it kills about a third of all people in Europe. Not overnight, but it lingers for a number of generations. It kills maybe half of the population of England. And as a result of that, so many people die that labor becomes scarce and the surviving workers are able to charge much higher wages, which employers have to pay. And at the same time, there's still the same amount of land, the same amount of capital. So what the rich own is worth less, and the labor of the poor is worth more. The rich are less rich, and the poor are less poor, and inequality goes down for a number of generations till the plague goes away, population recovers, and real wages go down again. Now, I should say, though, and this is quite significant, I think, with reference to the present, that this is mediated by different factors. So in some cases, like England, workers are able to do so because the nobility, which is trying to resist them, doesn't succeed. They fail to push back on those demands by workers. And so living conditions improve for the masses. But in other parts of the world, in Central Eastern Europe, for instance, the elites maintain a united front. They crack down on workers and force them under sometimes even worse conditions than before. So the political system that's in place is an important variable in this.
And it's not just, and I know loss of life is a huge factor, but that's not the only factor. What are other things that happen in catastrophes that change public opinion and build a groundswell that states have to react to?
So if we go back to the Black Death, again, for a moment, even the late Middle Ages, when the plague rages, people lose confidence in established authority. They are more willing to confront secular authorities, the feudal lords, and bargain much harder for higher wages. And they also lose confidence in the Catholic Church because the Church is not able to do anything about the plague. They seek out alternative options. And in some sense, this prepares the ground later on for the Reformation.
And just talk to us then about the world wars and their dramatic effects on inequality, because that's obviously one of your four horsemen.
In this case, World War II had a particularly dramatic effect because any number of things come together. Returns on capital, which is mostly owned by the rich, falls dramatically because of the dislocations of warfare and because of aggressive government intervention in the private sector that curtails the profits that capitalists can make. The state imposes controls on prices, wages, rents, dividends, all kinds of things that reduce inequality. It raises taxation on incomes and wealth, especially for high earners and for rich people. There's full employment because of conscription and the war effort. Unions get stronger. And then after the war, after 1945, there are secondary effects because the attitudes are also affected by the experience of war. There is now the expectation that the state should do more for the common people, and that leads to the fully-fledged modern welfare state that we still have today. And Britain is, in fact, a textbook example of this dynamic.
Walter, I know that you don't argue that it's inevitable that inequality is reduced in the wake of a catastrophe. What are the factors that determine whether a catastrophe has a knock-on effect on inequality?
I think the single most important determinant is the severity of the disaster. It appears that in order to act as a leveling force, a disaster has to be really, really bad. Most wars don't reduce inequality. Most epidemics don't either. But if they reach catastrophic proportions and pervade societies in a very fundamental way, they can actually have that effect. The second variable would be, and I already referred to this in the context of the plague, would be the kind of political regime that is in place, because different societies respond differently to these shocks that occur through war or epidemics. And that also mediates the outcome. So, for instance, in World War I, some countries don't raise taxes. They just print a lot of money, and inequality actually goes up in those countries. And in other places, like the US or the UK, inequality goes down dramatically because the government takes different measures. So we always come back to the fact that political regime institutions matter quite a bit in determining the final outcome.
So if you look at the circumstances of the current crisis, what do you think your argument means for the likely impact and outcomes of coronavirus?
Well, there are obvious differences. We already know, luckily, mercifully, that the demographic effect isn't going to be nearly as severe as it was in earlier plagues. There's not going to be a shortage of labor that is going to drive up wages. Quite the opposite. Unemployment is going to keep wages down for the foreseeable future. I think ultimately everything depends on how severe this crisis will turn out to be in the end. if science comes through, if we get effective treatment, vaccines within a reasonable amount of time, if we don't enter a global economic depression, we'll probably see some return to a version of business as usual, which in Anglo countries will mean persistently high inequality. There's not going to be a major leveling effect. If, on the other hand, the crisis turns out to be even worse than we currently anticipate because the virus proves to be more intractable, or we have a global depression, then all bets are off, because then you will get even more inequality, immiseration in the short term. Well, that kind of discontent may destabilize the existing order and push the electorate in the direction of favoring more radical, more progressive, more transformative change, which is what happened, for instance, in the 30s in various ways. Right now, I don't think that's the most likely outcome, but the potential is certainly there.
Let's challenge this a little bit, Walter, because in a sense, you're obviously not wanting things to be worse, but you're saying if things got worse, it will be more likely to produce change. But you also said recently, if there is one lesson we can draw from history, it is what really matters is that the way that this kind of crisis shapes political preferences and decision making. Now, obviously, that would apply if things were worse. But I think it's not just in the UK, but also in the US, we have seen changes made by government and a light shone on the inadequacies of the safety net, which workers really matter to the core running of a society, issues about power at work, what the market values. Is it, and you're going to have to give me a crumb of hope here, Walter, so bear with me. Is it not the case that what you've said about the way a crisis shapes political preferences and decision-making is correct? And that, you know, there are reasons to be hopeful that some of the injustices that have been, that were there before this crisis, but have been exposed by this crisis, can be tackled.
Well, the grain of hope I can give you is that this is crisis number two. And crisis number one, 12 years ago, the financial crisis, in a way prepared the ground for this. This is when we really started talking about economic inequality. There would not have been a Bernie Sanders without the Great Recession. And it is possible that smaller crises that happen in relatively rapid succession will have a cumulative effect. So maybe if the current crisis builds on some of the things unleashed by the previous one, it can push us in the direction of strengthening the safety net, rethinking terms of taxation and so on. That is certainly an option. It may well be our best hope in this context.
And let me ask you this question. When you are teaching at Stanford before the lockdown, and I'm sure you have young students who are idealistic, and they hear about your work, and they say to you, but hang on a minute, Professor Scheidel, I'm working on climate change, $15 minimum wage, all of these campaigns. Are you really saying, you know, this is all futile unless you have these disasters?
I'm careful not to say it's futile.
Few.
But I want to make sure they understand it's really difficult and it takes much more than they might think it takes to effect real change. I'm sure you are much more familiar with this from your personal experience.
I am.
No doubt. And I think in that sense, my argument is maybe helpful. It shouldn't be taken as pure defeatism. But I think it is important for policymakers or the citizenry in general to have some awareness of just how high the obstacles are to any real change in times of peace and stability. History doesn't always give us a lot of hope. And that you can take to mean we simply have to work even harder. Well, we have to try even harder to make this happen, develop new ways of addressing this problem, because we don't want to sit around waiting for the next crisis to strike.
That's a good note to end on. Professor Walter Scheidel, thanks so much for joining us.
And we're delighted to talk now to Theda Skocpol, who is Professor of Government and Sociology at Harvard University. Theda, hello. How's life under lockdown for you?
Well, it's a somewhat more boring version of normal. The only big problem is that my husband and I normally go out for breakfast at a diner here at 6 o'clock in the morning and interact with the regulars at 6 a.m., which is a small group, and we miss them all.
What's the diner called, Theda?
Andy's Diner, and there's an article about it, actually. If you if you put Andy's Diner and my name in, you're going to see an article that was done by the Harvard Gazette a year ago, because our group were big, are big Patriots fans, New England Patriots.
Me too. Now, Theda, we began this podcast by talking to Walter Scheidel and his book, The Great Leveler, at a sort of top high level. Just for our listeners, give us a sense of the forces that you think shape the outcomes from crisis.
Well, when I look over the course of American history, I would say there are only two major crises that have promoted equality in various dimensions, and that would be the Civil War and World War II. Now, not coincidentally, those are the biggest wars in American history. The Civil War was actually the biggest in terms of the proportion of the population involved and the casualties. And it's sort of a characteristically American major crisis, and then it was about ourselves. But those two, they did something that's hard to do in American federal politics and capitalism. They forced more of an alliance between the most privileged elites in the society and the mass of the population. Partly because the military side of both of those struggles required large numbers of soldiers. But also because they created a moral economy in which privileged elites felt a lot of peer pressure and a lot of approval from the society for committing themselves to a solidarity with everyone else.
And just to be clear for our listeners, you're one of the most important contributions you've made to the field. You edited a book, I think, called Bringing the State Back In. And so really what you're partly identifying in your work is this, right, is that the structure of states, the extent to which there's a centralized authority, the extent to which power is dispersed, the nature of patronage in those states, that's one of the things that's fundamental to determining whether change can happen at these kind of, you know, and we'll come on to talk about this moment, but at these moments of crisis.
Right. I think about kind of the intersection of the structure of the economy and the kinds of class forces that any good Marxist would talk about with the institutional structure of government, of state power. And you have to understand what's distinctive about each and how they come together to get a sense of the terrain on which public opinion or social movements operate in a crisis. It's not that public opinion doesn't matter. It's not that social or that voters don't matter. It's not that social movements are unimportant. But how they're going to play out really depends a lot on the structure of the economy and how it intersects with the structure of state power.
And the example of that in your work would be that in the UK, at least when it came to the early part of the 20th century, the forces that would be requesting a welfare state were more able to sort of penetrate, if you like, and have impact on the state than in the US.
Yeah, I mean, let's take both Britain and, say, Sweden. These are both countries that in different forms and to different degrees had professionalized civil services. By the time you get to the industrial era and the rise of trade unions, there is a capable state organization that could implement more egalitarian policies if its political direction could be shifted that way. So when the Labour Party or even the Labour Party and the Liberals begin to gain power in Britain, they've got something they can work with. That was much less true in the United States. It was kind of any step forward for labor power was always tentative. And it wasn't until the 1930s that you even got in certain spheres of the federal government the germs of a civil service that could carry through new social programs if they could get enacted through Congress.
And so why in that context does Franklin Roosevelt's, and I know these are big questions, why does his New Deal, which was, you know, about America getting out of the Depression and was a massive program of Keynesian investment, why does that, how does that happen then in the context of the forces that you're talking about?
Well, it didn't really happen until you piled World War II on top of the Great Depression. I'm a historical institutionalist. That means that I take these institutional forms into account. I also look at the sequence of things. And the fact, I think if you just had the Great Depression and you had not had World War II after the Great Depression in the United States, it might be that very little of what we know as the New Deal state would have survived or been carried through effectively.
Can we talk about the current coronavirus crisis? How do you envisage society will change in the United States and, in fact, around the world in the wake of this crisis?
We need optimism here, Theda.
Well, in any crisis like this, well, any crisis really, my perspective says that you must look what was going on before you went into the crisis to see what might be either exacerbated or shift during the crisis. So it's not a determinant perspective, and it really isn't here. I mean, I personally believe that there are both tragic possibilities here and very hopeful ones. And they depend, just as was true 3 months ago before we had this lockdown, on who wins the 2020 election. Because you are seeing not a pulling together of American elites in the faces of this pandemic crisis, but a further exacerbation of their divisions about the role of government and about how far to go, for example, in sustaining employment for less privileged workers. That'll change if the Democrats win these elections next fall, if the Democrats win the presidency and carry the Senate.
Bring the two parts together, the sort of history and your analysis of the current situation. And I know this is a very, very hard question to answer, but what's the sort of space in which social movements and ideas can determine outcomes? Give us a sort of insight into what you learn about this role of social movements and ideas.
Well, that's where some of my current research and my colleagues and I have been doing. We've really studied three major forces that have been playing out over the last 20 years and then are coming to a dramatic denouement. We've tracked the growth of ultra-free market millionaire, billionaire forces, the Koch Network and others, that have really been trying to dismantle any kind of national government capacity to tax and spend and regulate the market economy. And then there are two major popular social movements that have played out in the United States in the last decade. When Barack Obama was elected president, the Tea Party broke out. And the Tea Party has elite elements, but at its base, it was a nationwide voluntary movement of middle-class Americans, older whites, very alarmed at the changing ethnic composition of the country and the possibility that government might redistribute. On the other hand, when Trump was elected along with Republicans, that's just 8 years after the Tea Party explosion, you had an equally, even actually our research shows, more extensive and better organized popular movement on the center left. And I think a lot of leftist commentary treats that as a movement of young people and people of color, but that's not really true. It was a bunch of older white women. But that popular citizens movement on the center left is what makes it likely that Democrats can win resounding victories this November. But both of these popular movements are white middle class movements. So it's a civil war inside the American white middle class about what the country means as a community going forward. And they also disagree profoundly about the role of government in providing basics like healthcare.
Last question, Theda. You said earlier on something very, very important and interesting, which is the two big moments of change that you'd identified in American history, or two big moments of change, were when the elite interests and the interests of ordinary people, in some sense, aligned. If there is to be the kind of profound change that you and I think I and Jeff would want to see, is that what needs to happen, or does it need to sort of buck that trend?
No, I mean, I think this movement on the center left at the popular level, it's a middle class movement. It has to energize and prod the remaining elements of the American elite establishments of various kinds. Business, academia, politics, in the direction of reasserting solidarity with the national community. Take somebody like Joe Biden. He doesn't thrill the American left, but he's a good guy, and he represents the side of the Democratic Party that would be perfectly prepared to go as far as they can go. In extending health care, educational opportunity, investing in climate change remedies. He's not going to do it alone, but he's not going to stand in the way. And he has allied with him going into this election the more public regarding elements of American elite life.
Well, look, Theda, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Go Pats, as only a few people listening to this podcast will understand. and thank you so much for joining us. It's been incredibly informative, educational, and enlightening.
All right. Well, thank you. I've enjoyed talking with you.
So, Jeff, what did you think?
Well,
got more optimistic as it went along, didn't it?
It did. And something I think I have asked loads of times on this podcast is, why after 2008 we didn't see big change come along. And I thought, well, maybe an answer to that is that it's not one of Walter's four horsemen. So maybe that's why there wasn't big change in the wake of 2008. But sort of more pertinently, something Theda said was that actually these ideas, they don't just come out of nowhere. During a moment of crisis, they are the ideas that have been talked about, you know, and the campaigns, the grassroots campaigns, the movements, and it made me feel sort of broadly positive about the ideas we've been talking about on the podcast for these past few years. If this is a point in human history where people are going to look at what ideas are on the shelf, then the time could come for a lot of our Reasons to Be Cheerful ideas.
You know, it's interesting you should say that, because you and Milton Friedman, the right-wing economist, think in similar ways.
I'm always been compared to Milton Friedman.
So Milton Friedman said, when crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. That, I believe, is our basic function, to develop alternatives to existing policies, to keep them alive and available until the politically impossible becomes a politically inevitable. Which I think is a sort of interesting quote. And I wouldn't say change is politically inevitable. But as I said in the interview, you know, this crisis has shone a light on some really fundamental problems in society. Now, I think at the moment we're in the rescue phase where we've got to do absolutely everything to protect people through this crisis. But there will come a time when we've got to then think about, well, what do we build? As Hannah Martin said last week, we're not just going to rebuild the house in the same way. And therefore, what does that rebuilding look like? And I suppose the other thing I come out of these discussions thinking is, why is it useful, our listeners might be thinking, because certainly Walter was pretty pessimistic. I think it's useful because you've got to you know, sense of history is always useful, but also it's not just about the ideas, it's the social forces, the social movements that are available to push those ideas. And those movements, so the ideas matter, but the movements that we build, the forces that we build, are also incredibly important.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
As ever, we're really enjoying hearing from you, but especially during these weird times. If you've got anything you would like to contribute, anything you'd like to say about episodes that you've heard already, or ideas for what we could be talking about on the podcast, then do get in touch. Do it through the website, cheerfulpodcast.com. This comes from Nancy and Jason, who say, "We generally listen while we're working together in our small restaurant in Suffolk. We're currently doing deliveries and takeouts. Saw this and thought it was worth a mention and a push to those making decisions and planning around air pollution and making Britain less car centric." And then there's a link to an article in The Guardian online about cities which are turning their streets over to walkers and cyclists, which is something we've talked about a bit, but I'm a big fan of walking, and I think both Ed and I would do more cycling if there was less traffic about.
Well, I'd do more cycling if I didn't fall off, but I'm just badly coordinated. But I completely agree with the principle. I think Oakland, closed off like 80 of their streets to allow people to walk around during lockdown.
That's great.
So I think it's a good, I think it's a really good point.
It is weird when you go out, there's so little traffic on the roads, and it's weird how people don't move into the road to give each other a bit of space.
I'm a big road into the road mover.
Me too. I wish more people would do it.
Yeah, I think it's a good principle. This one comes from Helen Beckett. "Hi, I really enjoyed the latest podcast and hope the government do consider how to make a green exit from this crisis. Do you think in your new role, Ed, you could lead a campaign for Grexit?" Yes. I think the problem about Grexit is it might have been taken by Greek exit from the European Union. I don't know. What do you think, Jeff?
I mean, you could get in touch with the Greeks and see if they'd be up for a rebrand.
Recovery, maybe.
Very good, yeah.
Or should I just stick to the day job? Hope you keep up the good work, so important, but especially at this moment. No, I think it's really important, and you can count on me, Helen. It was useful to learn from last week's episode, and it's something I'm very focused on.
And this comes from Marco. And do you remember we were talking about 3D printers making PPE? This is a similar vein. Marco says, "A few weeks ago, we set up a volunteer initiative to help with PPE shortage in the UK. It's sos-supplies.com. We saw suppliers who have PPE stock in the UK. Many of them even offer same-day delivery. And we match them up with charities and organisations who need urgent supplies."
I do think the response on this on PPE has been incredible, from people sort of stepping up to the challenge of supplying it, hasn't it? I mean, we obviously covered it, but it is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet at Cheerful Podcast.
And this week on our Cheerful People slot, I am more than delighted to say that we have Paul Sinton Hewitt, the extraordinary founder of Parkrun. Thank you so much for coming on. And I know you will have told this story thousands of times, but I think it bears repeating for our listeners. How did it all start, Paul?
Well, it's 15 years ago. You know, I progressed through society as you do. I had a fairly full life, lots of international travel, lots of business, lots of stress, difficult marriage that didn't work out, stuff that we all deal with. And throughout my life, I had periods of what I now know to be depression. In those days, I just saw it as being difficult, where I would have mood swings and I would find myself in a position of antagonism. And 15 years ago, a whole bunch of things came crashing down. I was working, got fired. I had a relationship that broke down. And then I was on a really determined path to run my best ever marathon at London Marathon. And in a cross-country match for my local club, I tripped and fell, and I tore most of the left of my, side of my body. The bottom line was that I couldn't run. I had some diagnosis, and And they said it'll be a couple of years before you can run. So I'm 42. I've just run a 240 marathon. And I had in sight a 230 marathon. My previous best was 236.
Wow.
This is all taken away. I've got this black space. And the long and the short of it was I thought, well, I've just got to get out. Running had been a part of my life for very long, and it had smoothed the ups and the downs. And there I was stuck, not being able to do that. So I thought, well, probably past doing any sort of competitive running again, 42, why don't I start to give back to my local community? And I thought, well, what's the one thing I could do that nobody else has ever done? And I came across this format, very, very simple 5K in a park. It's always the same route. It's always at exactly the same time.
But it hadn't done. But it wasn't. Week. It wasn't happening, was it?
Well, it had happened in South Africa.
Right.
Not very different to what we do. But the format of just pitching up and running a 5K time.
And this
trial.
Is 2004. You start doing it in Bushy Park.
Yeah.
And you and 12. No.
Five. There were four other volunteers and 13 runners.
13 runners on a particular Saturday in 2004.
2nd of October when I started.
So was it done like it was done as a.
No.
No. Right.
So on day one, 13 people lined up. I had produced a map of the course. It's Bushy Park. It's a very simple course. You run around the perimeter and you come back, keep the trees on your left, etc. And I said to everyone, look, if you get it wrong, just don't hassle. Come back next week and you'll get it right.
Yeah. So that is how it started. I think we should then just sort of totally fast forward to today. Give us the stats. How many people, how many countries, how many parks?
We're now in, I think, 23 countries. We're now just in excess of 2,000 weekly events. They're on a weekly participation, we're around about 350,000 people who participate. There's 6 million people registered.
6 million people?
About 1.5 million register every year, new. So that's growing by 1.5 million every year. We've got in excess of 500,000 volunteers. And in any one particular year, I would imagine around 300,000 or 400,000 of them participate, volunteer.
I mean, it's just extraordinary because I've become a parkrun board, Jeff tells me. But I mean, you know, I was in Canada last summer in Vancouver and I schlepped to the place in Vancouver where the parkrun happens and did it. And, you know, I was coming away at the end and talking to some other people, I think Brits who were there, and we were saying, isn't it extraordinary? There's just no way being on holiday you would decide to go and do a 5 kilometre run first thing in the morning. I mean, that's not really what I was, me anyway, I wouldn't do that. But there's something about the institution and the idea and the fraternity and all of that.
So it is ironic because when I was a runner in my early years, so the first 20 years of running, I would never have got out of bed to run a 5K.
Yeah.
I mean, who would do that? That's just... You know, I used to say to myself, if I didn't run for more than 40 minutes, it wasn't really a run. It wasn't building on anything.
Right.
It was park run is much more than a run. And of course, the way I like to perceive it is when you build your house, you don't really think about the plumbing. You just want it hidden. It's there. It's essential. Without it, it doesn't work. Park run, the run in park run is like the plumbing in a house. So everything else is amplified. The people you meet, the people who help you around the course. There are so many stories from people whose lives are changed through the experience. It's not about the 5K run doesn't save anyone. Of course it makes you healthier and it makes you feel better about yourself. But it's all of these things together which have that total well-being effect that you get when you're feeling great.
I mean, the fact it's free is really important, isn't it?
I think it's a fundamental part of what has made it what it is today. So there are very few barriers to taking part in a park run. Clearly, there are always barriers, depending on where you are in your life. But I would suggest that there are very few barriers. And with the approach that we have, that everyone's welcome, we'll do the very best we can to help you get round, we'll make it as simple and as fun as possible. I think it has enabled the swelling of participation.
I mean, look, Did you have any idea when you started it what would happen?
No, and I'm pleased I didn't, because I probably wouldn't have done it.
But at what point did you realise, oh, this is
a big deal? Yeah.
You have to remember that this is a weekly affair.
It's incremental.
Yeah. And if you take week by week, the growth is marginal. If you take it over a year, it tends to be in the first, say, 5 years, around 30-40%. And it just keeps going.
And you resisted for a long time, exactly, going beyond Bushy Park, didn't
exactly
you?
So I had two friends who counseled me in that first year. And, of course, the questions were, well, how can you possibly make this work? It's got no business model whatsoever. And they were right. It's a volunteer-led initiative where I was funding it. And there was no real prospect of it being a financially stable product. And I was proud of that. In fact, everything we did was to come away from that. So the fact that it was free, the fact that we didn't want to call it a race, the fact that we published everything.
Yeah.
We didn't try and hide anything. Yeah. We made it as accessible as possible. I wasn't trying to build a product that would eventually become financially successful. That was never the goal. But what I did want was for everyone to have a great experience. So from day one, it didn't matter whether you ran with a dog or a buggy.
Yeah.
It didn't matter whether you were a runner even.
Yeah.
That was fundamental to the whole thing. And free was a barrier. Even if we charged a pound.
Yeah.
I reckon we wouldn't be half.
Yeah, I completely
agree
with that.
The community we are today.
You know, they have this thing in computing, the Moore's law. It doubles, the computing power doubles every 18 months. I mean, what is Sinton-Hewitt's law here? I mean, it's been exponential,
and it'll continue to be that. I think what has amazed me. So in 2015, I stepped back from day to day running the company. What I think has happened is at that point, I started to run out of my own steam. Where was this going? The only thing I could think of was we'd have more runs in more places around the world.
Yeah.
Nick Pearson, Tom Williams stepped in, and between us came up with the we'll make the world a healthier and happier place. So you start to think about, well, what can you do in the context of a free Saturday run with volunteer-led community? What can you
do? And diversity is important in that, as
equality,
your colleague said when he was on the podcast.
Yeah. So the whole idea of what we can do as an organization all of a sudden became, well, the world's our oyster. And I go to the board meetings and I'm often quite surprised by the next initiative that's being touted. And it's always, I mean, I couldn't have come up with that myself. And I'm thinking, why didn't I think of that? How brilliant is that? And it's all about making the world healthier and happier.
How many have you done?
I'm on 460-something.
Oh, that's quite a lot.
What are you up to?
About 37, 38.
Yeah, your red shirt's on its way.
Yeah, I know. I'm looking forward to it. Come on, Jeff. This year.
The way I see it, it's got to be something that comes to you when you're ready. And it doesn't really matter when you're ready. When you are ready, go and enjoy it. And you'll find that there are certain things that'll tick your box. And they'll get you more engaged, more involved. But if you're not ready,
would you walk around with me?
Yeah, but then I'd feel bad because I'd be holding you back and then bringing your average down.
Average is not important.
No, we don't care about that.
Okay.
So my fastest park run is about 18:20, done a few years ago after I came back from injury. My slowest is about 54 minutes. And it was probably the most valuable experience I had.
What was that?
So I went to North Harlow Fields, which is a very diverse community on the west of London. And I had a small Achilles injury, so I decided I would just walk at the back. And a chap, young 16-year-old Asian boy, was walking behind me. So I turned to him and said, well, what's your story? He said, oh, it's my first park run. So I said, oh, how come you're here? He said, oh, my dad, who I don't live with, brought me. And he does it regularly, and now I'm doing it. I said, oh, okay. And we started chatting. So I focused on the things that might be interesting to him. What do you do at school? And what are your best subjects? And how is it going? And then he starts saying to me, how much further do we have? And I say, okay, well, we've got 2 kilometers to go. And then it was 1.5, and then it was 1. And by the time we finished, he was so elated about having finished, he had completely forgotten about the distance. We were all talking about stuff. And then he found out that I was the founder of Parkrun, and he turned to me and said, this is probably the most significant day in my life. I've just completely blown my mind that this event exists, that I can do it at my pace. And he brought his dad over, and his dad nearly fell over because I had done the whole Parkrun.
Story. And Elsie, if I may say, Paul, I mean, for somebody who's done such an extraordinary thing, you have an incredible humility about it.
Well, it,
I mean, well, I just noticed that at Finsbury Park when we met, that you were very, very, you know, what's the right word? You sort of, you know, you were kind of low key about,
well,
you know.
Well, Parkrun is an amazing organisation. It's an amazing collection of people, and the volunteers deserve all the credit. The fact of the matter is, all I created was this tiny little free, simple 5K run around a park. I set out the morals and the values and so on, and the people have got behind that, and they've said, this is worthwhile, it's worth protecting, we are going to look after it. And it's now being looked after by hundreds of thousands of people. Clearly, I'm still part of it, and I don't think I ever want not to be part of it. But it's clear to me that this is, its brilliance is because of the people who are involved, not just me, and definitely not only me.
Well, look, Paul Sintonier, I mean, you've definitely given us reasons to be
absolutely
cheerful.
Absolutely.
I think the jury is out on whether... Well, you should do it in your own time.
That's
when
that's
you're
what
ready.
Paul said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When will you be ready?
Stop pushing me. I'll get there.
You'll get there. Yeah. Paul Sintonier, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So we're in the outro, and I feel like I need to sort of make up for not wishing you a happy birthday at the start of the episode. So I want to sort of reinforce my happy birthday. Would you like me to sing happy birthday while washing my hands twice? No, while singing it twice while washing my hands?
I'd just like to watch you washing your hands twice without a soundtrack.
Really? I'm not sure you would. What's your plan for your birthday?
I don't know. I'm sort of leaving it up to my wife to fill my day with delights and surprises. Who knows what that will look like in coronavirus. But that's my plan so far.
I fear my present to you we'll have to wait till lockdown ends because I don't want to disobey social distancing rules.
That's what Sarah said as well. She tried to order something about a week before. And
there's quite long delays.
Yeah, it says it's not going to be arriving until the beginning of June. So I've resigned. I don't mind. I don't like too much of a fuss.
You can rest assured that I will be not buying you another vegan cheesemaker come the end of lockdown. Because I think one vegan cheesemaker, even though it's a brilliant present, is enough for any man or woman.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. No man needs 2 vegan cheesemakers. It's greedy.
Maybe in the coming year, we can make vegan cheese together.
Maybe that could be the first thing we do when we come out of social distancing.
Should we thank our guests? I'd like to thank Walter Scheidel and Peter Scotchpole.
And thanks to the brilliant Paul Sinton-Hewitt. What an inspirational gentleman. Thanks to Emma Corsham, who produces our podcast. Research is by Joel Pearce, with Pavlina Dragonova, Eli Madison-Evans and Joe Kenyon. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. Ed Seed composed the music. James Deacon made our little idents. And our artwork was designed by
Henry Cole.
He's been Ed Miliband.
He's been Jeff Lloyd.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.